Hello, lovely listeners. As you know, we support the Undershaw Preservation Trust, and we'd like to say we deeply appreciate it if you've bought books or merchandise from their website or promoted their cause to your friends. The Tumblr user Your Guide to Deduction is at the moment pulling together fun efforts to create a fun book which will be sold in support of the Undershaw Preservation Trust. At present, UPT cannot accept donations, but they will be able to do so after the judicial review in May. So, if you're a fan writer or artist, or a Holmesian or Sherlockian scholar, this is your chance to shine. Have an unposted story in your Works in Progress folder? A drawing or a painting that needs finishing? An article about Holmes, Watson and their world? Fictional and non-fictional writing and fan art for the canon or any of the adaptations is welcome. Even something you've posted elsewhere can be submitted, so don't be shy if you can't create something specifically for the book. And even if you can't create anything, but you know an awesome writer or a brilliant fan artist, giving them a nudge towards the book would be much appreciated. There are 5 categories for filing submissions, including Beneath the Hat, Who is Sherlock Holmes, 1895, and The Fall. For more details and to submit work to the fanbook, please follow the link on our website or Google Art of Deduction fanbook. Much thanks in advance from us and from the Undershaw Bods. Thank you.
Hey guys, I want to talk to you about the coolest publication out there. The Baker Street Journal. It's a publication of the Baker Street Irregulars, and it has been going on since 1946. It has articles about everything Sherlock Holmes and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and everything you could want if you're a Sherlockian. You do not have to be a member of the Baker Street Irregulars to read the journal or to submit content. If you've got anything that you want to write about, you can get in touch with them and you can submit it via www.bakerstreetjournal.com. It's fun, it's educated, it's everything you're looking for in a Sherlock Holmes publication. And hey, if you get published, you get bragging rights with all your friends. It's amazing, you've got to check it out.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two one
in mine? Hello, ladies and jelly spoons. It's your captain speaking. I just want to let you know about the amazing interview you're about to listen to. It's with Michael Price, who is one half of the brilliant composing team of BBC Sherlock. Sadly, David is being quite Olympic at the moment, but we'll grab him later. So, if you don't know who Michael Price is, you should be very ashamed of yourself. But chances are you've definitely heard something he's done. One, Sherlock. But he edited on Lord of the Rings, helped with Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, Nanny McPhee. I love Nanny McPhee. There's tons of stuff that this guy's done, and he was very gracious in sitting down with us for the time that he could. So, get ready for some amazing music stuff. It's good fun. It's delightful. Go share your love with him, because he likes love. We should all love him. I'm going to stop talking now.
We have Michael Price here. Yay!
Yay!
Love clapping noises. Obviously, Michael Price is one of the amazing team of the Sherlock soundtrack and everything. So thank you again. Thank you so much for joining in on this. This is brilliant, brilliant news. And I was talking the same to Michael earlier, but we got a ton of questions for him. But in general, we're just going to chat about the amazing music that is on Sherlock, the 2 soundtracks that you've put out now, and sort of get to know you.
Maybe disappointing in so many different ways.
I'll let you off a little bit easy, but usually when we interview people, you have to become an honorary Baker Street babe, and you have to answer some questions.
Oh. I can only imagine what they would be. Oh, no, fire away. I'm very happy to answer them, whatever they are, or not. I'll just talk about.
All right. Well, I guess first question, like, how did you get into Sherlock Holmes? Was Sherlock your first introduction to it, or did you know about it before? Did you read the stories as kids or anything?
I think it was really interesting when David, and I have to sort of stress right from the start that all the music for Sherlock is truly a team sport between David, Arnold, and myself. It's a very kind of, it's a very close collaboration all the way through, and has been for years, because we've worked together for nearly 10 years now. Yeah. And so really the kind of the, obviously I knew about the Sherlock Holmes canon, but I can't say really that I read it very much as a kid. So when we came to, I can remember David and I going down into Soho to watch the pilot episode, which we were brought on very much at the last minute to have a look at anyway. And so really I didn't, you know, I kind of knew about Basil Rathbone. I knew about the feature films that were the Robert Downey Jr. ones that were going to be made, although they hadn't been made at that point. And I sort of deliberately not watched them. I hear they're amazing, which is great. But I sort of deliberately tried to just stay pure to Benedict. make sure that, you know, not colored by anything else. But, and so for me, seeing, Martin Freeman and Benedict Cumberbatch on screen was almost, for me, it was kind of like, okay, so this is Sherlock Holmes then. And it was a wonderful, sort of quick introduction. And it wasn't really until I'd started, until we started working on the pilot. And then there was a long pause before season one, we started working on that. And we wondered whether it had gone away entirely or whether, you know, quite what would happen. But when we started speaking to, Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss in greater depth about it, and if you spend time with them, the two of them are such glorious enthusiasts about everything to do with Sherlock Holmes and the series, that it becomes infectious. And I actually started reading, when we were doing season one, started going back reading some of the books, just flicking through them on various trains to catch all the clever things that Mark and Stephen were managing to put into the scripts, because it was sort of like, there was two or three moments where they were chortling away, just going, this is marvellous, how wonderfully funny this is. And I was sitting back, not getting the reference at all, going, yeah, it's quite funny. Why is it that funny? actually, I kind of, but as soon as you go back, and for people who are fans and know the canon works terribly well, I think there's a whole layer of extra fun to be had in this series, because they are so detailed and so, I was going to say respectful, but I don't think that's quite the right word, because it doesn't include all the fun that they have at the original's expense in a way. It's just that real joy in the source material and how to bring it to life.
I think you answered that quite well.
At great length. We apologize.
Fair enough.
Next.
So, of the ones that you have read, what's your favorite story, if you can remember?
Well, I think when we started looking at a study in pink, study in scarlet, I think it was that sense of going back to that and seeing the characters writ large. So I think it was flicking through Study in Scarlet on the train, probably on the way to Cardiff as well. Because David and I only went to Cardiff once, because Cardiff is a very long way from London. So it takes a long time to get there. And so consequently, we always try to feign some sort of reason why everybody had to come to us, rather than us going and seeing Paul McGuigan in Cardiff. And apart from the first time we succeeded, so I almost certainly it was flicking through Study in Scarlet on the train on the way to Cardiff.
Now, you said you were very loyal to Benedict. Does that mean that Sherlock Holmes is your favorite character, or do you have another one?
I think it's really interesting. It's such a, Benedict's performance is such a virtuoso, I mean, it's an incredible piece of screen acting. There's no getting around the fact that he is electrifying on screen. It's just astonishing to watch. And it was in the early pilot, but I felt that he kind of, whether everybody, by the time we started doing season one, certainly by season two, he inhabits that, the character of Sherlock in such a spectacularly bright-eyed, intelligent, fiery way. It's difficult not to react to his portrayal. But I think Martin Freeman, because if you've just got one person showing off on screen all the time, and you haven't got a balance to that, you haven't got a character that you can relate to that can then be your eyes and ears in that situation, I think it just becomes a bit annoying. Mm-hmm. And because Martin's performance as Watson is so intelligently grounded, he's not some sort of second fiddle character where, you know, he's not the butt of the joke, which I think is what's so wonderful. You know, he's a courageous man with, you know, integrity and silly jumpers. It's a great combination. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of the way that the two of them balance up, I think, is the success of it. So I suppose my favorite character is Holmes and Watson, the balance between the two, really.
Very good answer. I think we'd all completely agree with you there.
Yeah. I think I'm gonna start using that from now on. Integrity and silly jumpers. That's the best thing ever.
Yeah, and the last question is what's your favorite adaptation? But I think that's pretty easily answered for you, I imagine.
Well, you know, it's sort of by which you mean which of the episodes in terms of their adaptation from the original, or just
like the favorite adaptation, so like the Granada series, the Robert Downey Jr. film.
Oh, I see. Now I get you. Sorry, I'm with you. Yes, no, this one without question. I mean, if I see anything. And obviously, once you become part of the larger Sherlock family, you can't help kind of seeing things popping up on reruns on TV or obviously, you know, and the films, I'm really pleased for their success, and apparently they, you know, say they're wonderful. But my own personal take on it is that I've just been really enjoying our interpretation of it and consequently being sort of very committed to this world. I think for the period of time that we're making these shows, is something I get a lot of satisfaction out of. I think it's, you know, it kind of feels like a family. The production company are wonderful. Everybody's amazing on it. We get, David and I get, I was going to say enough rope to hang ourselves, but it's not quite what I mean. We, you know, we get a lot of leeway to do what we want to do, but then we're collaborating with people at the absolute peak of their powers, which is, you know, it's a very wonderful position to be in. I was talking to somebody about it the other day, and not that sporting metaphors are particularly my strong point, but it feels a bit like playing in the World Cup winning Brazilian team in the 70s or something like that, where kind of everybody else is amazing, absolutely nailing it. And your job really is just to try not to trip up over your own feet or kind of hoof it over the bar. So when you've got Stephen Moffat writing at the peak of his powers, you've got Martin and Benedict, absolutely amazing. The whole cast are amazing. And Paul McGuigan, the director of sort of two out of the three of the episodes each time, you know, these are world-class people at the very peak of their careers, I think, at the moment. So we just try not to screw up, basically.
I think that translates really well, because you can just tell that everyone loves what they're doing, and I think that's what makes the show so well-loved.
Absolutely. I feel probably more, in a way, more committed to this, although don't tell some of the other directors I've worked with, but I feel, let's say, as committed to this as anything that I've ever done. I think it's something to be proud of and something to enjoy, I think, to enjoy the wider reaction of everybody to the show and outside the show, and why not? I think these days it's sort of, you know, half the fun of an event TV show like Sherlock is in the anticipation in the press and online before, and then the conversations that it sparks afterwards, whether that's about, you know, how did he do it at the end of season two, or, you know, kind of what will happen next, all those kind of things. I think it's a wonderfully sort of, it's one of the things that both Stephen and Mark are fabulous are about, a sort of gently teasing everyone with just enough information to kind of frustrate and antagonize, but then on the other hand, actually then deliver something really great when, you know, when it comes to the first episode of season two and, you know, and the kind of staying alive, then you more curiosity. That's great. Nobody saw that coming. I didn't see that online before. So yeah, so I think much as I respect everybody else's work, past, present, and almost certainly future with the CBS show, then I'm a Sherlock man through and through. I think Alice is great.
Well, there you go. You are now an official honorary Baker Street babe. Congratulations.
Yay!
Yay! I guess jumping right in, I mean, how did this sort of get started? Like, you and Dave, you said you and David had worked together for 10 years now. When you were approached with this, like, what did you think when you first got started with it all?
Yeah, Dave and I worked together on all kinds of projects for a long time. And I'd worked independently with Mark Gatiss on First Men in the Moon, which was a TV movie he did. And David and I had both worked with him on Crooked House, which is another TV show, a few years ago. And Mark and David knew each other from the comedy circuit, I think, a long time before. So it was one of those things where you sort of, initially the first... sorry, the cat's turned the computer on now. It's so slick here. It's just like Hollywood. You know? So when we got the call, which I think initially was from Mark to David to come down and have a look, there was a sense in the pilot episode that they had the bones of something amazing, but it just wasn't quite. It needed another turn around the clock to really sort of to bring out what was inside, and I think it was felt that music was part of that. So when Dave and I first watched it, we scored the pilot episode in just a couple of weeks, very very quickly, just on synths as well. There's no live recording. It was very sort of kind of quick and dirty, really, I suppose. But already we had a lot of the tunes there, a lot of the stuff that's still there in, you know, all the way into season two, was sort of came out in that very early pilot episode period. But then I think what's been very interesting has been the progression then between how season one developed and then how season two's developed. And I'm very proud of everyone's work in how the fact that season two is a genuine progression and a development on the work that was started in season one. So from small acorns, large, flowery oak trees. Sherlockness are growing. I'll stop talking now. What was this? Promise I haven't had a drink.
I wanted to know if you, what you just said, that it was a progression from the pilot to the first season and then to the second season. Do you think of each episode as an individual kind of frame to write music for, or did you already know that it was going to go from the first to the third episode of each season? So is the music that you wrote kind of, you know, spans over the entire season or just the episodes?
It's a very interesting question, and I think it's one of the things which maybe, if I can say, worked better in season two, is that because we were sort of, we didn't really know what we were dealing with in season one. I think we were sort of learning on the job as one always does, really, because we got the episodes in reverse order for a start. Because of the editing process and what was shot when and when scripts were delivered and everything, we actually saw episode three first and worked on that first, and then two and then one in season one, which meant that we were sort of kind of defining Sherlock's character in reverse musically. And I know, I mean, you never get a chance to sort of like go back and have a second go at something, except when you get season two. So I think we really felt that with season one, we'd sort of, by the time we'd done episode one, we'd kind of got a lot of stuff that we needed to get. But then when we knew season two was coming up and we saw the scripts well in advance, which is marvelous. In fact, I went to a wonderful read through of episode three this time, Reichenbach Fall. Mm. Which is, I don't know if you've ever been to one of those sort of script read-throughs, but the top floor of some very unprepossessing building somewhere in West London, a church hall kind of thing. Lots of people just sitting around a big table, and there's kind of 50 or 60 people there from production and everybody, all the cast, everybody who needs to be there. But because everybody's in civvies and there's no costumes or anything like that, it just looks like a church meeting, really. Or maybe, you know, it's like arranging the flowers for the next Harvest Festival. And then, but of course, Benedict's there. And so this sort of, you know, everybody starts reading through the first lines, and it's kind of, and it's great hearing everybody read, but then the first line for Sherlock comes on and Benedict reads it and the entire room just goes, "Oh my God, that's wonderful." And so from the start of season two, I think both David and I were really clear that we had to create very distinct sonic and musical characters for each of the three episodes in season two, which I'm not sure we achieved in season one. I think it was kind of great. You know, I hoped it was good and it was, you know, kind of worked well all the way through the season. But I think in season two, we were clearer. We knew that we wanted the Hound episode to be really visceral and distorted and scary and electronic sounding and aggressive and not, you know, not kind of slightly namby-pamby TV music, you know, it needed to be really quite hard-hitting movie music.
Yeah.
And we knew for the woman, for episode one, you know, that was such a great episode. So that really needed to be off the scale, kind of emotional, large scale, which is really difficult when you've got 2 weeks to write it. And but it, you know, it needed to have that emotional connection. And then there was, you know, if we were responsible for letting people down at the end of Reichenbach and not rising to the challenge of what was going on screen, then we should be fired and sent home, because, you know, everybody else was working so hard to get the last 20 minutes of the last episode performance wise beautiful. So I think this time around it was a sort of a, we were more defined, and I think it comes out on screen.
I mean, the ending's perfect, and all the elements come together just perfectly.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because it goes a bit with the fact that I think Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat have said a few times, it's like making mini movies. So it allows you, in terms of composing music, to go into that place like you can have sometimes in movies as well, which is making a theme for a certain character, which is not necessarily a luxury you can have in TV most of the time. So this is one of the things that's brilliant about the soundtrack as well for Sherlock, is you have this sense of identity in the music as well, which is fantastic. Mm. So yeah, it does go into a bit movie territory without going too much there either, but it is very, it's bigger, and that's what makes it amazing, actually, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. I get a bit carried away here.
It's always good. It's better than the opposite. I never liked it. Terrible.
No.
I think it's a very, very interesting point about what makes movie music and what makes TV music and what made Sherlock work well. And I think it's probably because it's sort of the hybrid between the two. We have moments where everybody, not just the music, the whole cinematography and the performances, production design, the writing, everything is going for something which is broader in scale. But you still can't lose sight of the fact that the majority of people are going to watch this on a TV in their home. And so it is a different intention than an actual cinema movie, because there's a directness of storytelling. The framing, photography is different, the writing is different. And so you sort of really, as composers, because we're the last people that come on, you know, everybody else has done their job pretty much, and we just respond to what everybody else is doing. Then it's really trying to sort of authentically and emotionally respond very truthfully to what's on screen. So when it goes big, go big with it. If it's small and intimate, and it's just two characters talking through the TV at you and being very close to you, then respond to that and be respectful of it and be touched by it as well.
When you start, do you start composing from the scripts, or do you wait until everything's been filmed?
No, totally fair point. If you, as you sometimes do, if you get sent the scripts early, it's wonderful. But I've found over the years that any music I write to the script, I always end up throwing away, because it's you're really responding to what's on screen. And you're also responding, and David made this point in another interview, which I thought was a very astute point, is that you're responding to the film that the filmmakers have actually made, not the one they wanted to make. Mm. And those two things are sometimes slightly different. So the process really starts when you get an edited version of the film, and not enough time and not enough budget, and then just dive in and respond.
Two parts from two of our fans. From Tumblr, Moriarty Lives in Chum asks if you have a favorite track, and ooh, Chloe J. Hume asks if one section was harder than another to compose for.
Oh, very good questions. David and I have different favourite tracks. He likes Sherlocked, and I like Blood on the Pavement.
Oh, that one.
You can read into that what you would like, but those are our favourite tracks. And in terms of harder, it's all hard, and usually for slightly different reasons. And often some of the difficult, sort of tricky stuff isn't the big showy stuff. It tends to be sort of sneaking around cues and getting the pacing right in long sequences, and you know, things like the lab scenes in Hounds, even though you're probably not that aware of the music really, is, you know, those are very challenging to do because you're very aware of the music when it's wrong. So it's kind of trying to keep sustained tension over a long period of time and those longer arcs, because these are 90-minute shows. So often some of the technical difficulty is sort of behind the scenes, so to speak. And then the bits where you just get to play a big tune, in a way, are sort of a little bit more straightforward. If you got a good tune to play, just play it, sort of thing. Good question.
I know you said earlier when we were talking that you may have to answer certain questions with a, I can't say anything. But I'm just curious, do you know the resolution to Reichenbach? Just curious if you know it or not.
Well, all I can say on the matter is that when we sat with the director and producer of that episode, Toby, he did explain it to us. And even as he explained it, I could feel it slipping from my fingers. So basically, Dave and I were going, really? So he, and then he, no, surely not. So we have been privy to that information, but I can put my hand on my heart and say that I don't know, really. And also, Stephen will have probably got them to lie to us anyway, because they know that we're all talking. So I'm as in the dark as everybody else. Well, perhaps not quite that dark.
Okay. I was just curious. Okay. We have a few more fan questions, if you don't mind.
Of course.
All right. On Tumblr, Songsters Miscellany asked, well, they said they were very interested in the music that the characters can hear, as well as the audience. And were the pieces selected for Sherlock to play on his violin in the second season intended to communicate anything about his character?
Some of that we're not involved in. Some of that's scripted. So the Bach pieces that Sherlock was playing, actually, I believe, and I'm very open to correction on this, that they refer back. I can remember there being a conversation about there's an equivalent scene in a Basil Rathbone film where he's playing the violin and Moriarty is coming up the stairs to meet him. And I believe yes. In our season, he's playing the same music. It was quite important for him to be playing the same music as he was in the Rathbone version. Now, I'm that's secondhand, so that may or may not be true, but that's what I heard.
I think that's true. I believe that is true.
Right. Good. It sounds right. It sounds like the kind of thing that you do. And also the track choices. So the Nina Simone track and the Phoebe Magpie track. They're scripted. David and I don't have any input into that. What we did have input into, though, obviously, was the tune that Sherlock composes. And so it was really important for us in the woman episode for that theme that he plays when he's thinking of Irene Adler to become the big theme that we all can hear. So if you do a little bit of analysis on what that violin figure is that he's playing and the chords that are implied by it, those chords become the main theme that you hear in Sherlock and the woman and all those big cues. And also then the little fragments of violin that you hear right at the very end of that episode when Sherlock's looking through the window, that's a quote from that original theme that he plays himself. And the high violin that sort of soars over the top just before the big reveal of Sherlock, of the phone code. That's also a quote of that. So it's important for us to try and integrate the source music, if you like, the on-screen music with the score. Good question.
Can I jump in with another question that is a bit related to how you work? When I listen to what you and David have been doing for the show, and also what you've been doing outside of the show, I can see you like using strings a lot and violins, and also you've been doing this recording recently that you broadcast.
Oh, yes.
You posted about it on Twitter. That was brilliant. Brilliant. And I was wondering if you had a favorite instrument, if you have a favorite like trend in terms of music where you like to go, how it applied to Sherlock as well, and all these kind of things.
No, totally. I mean, it's a great question. I think when you're scoring for a film or a TV show, you're really trying to sort of respond to what it needs. And so you try and take your own favorite things out of it. You know, sometimes a banjo is what it needs. And if it's, if it needs a banjo, it's going to get a banjo. Exactly. In Deliverance, it's genius. Absolutely genius. And so you're really trying to when you're working to pitch it, you're trying to leave your own personal preferences to one side. However, outside, when you're not working to pitch it, that's when I think you can allow yourself to be free and choose what you want to do. So yes, you'll see lots more of me doing strings coming up, bigger string groups probably, and to carry on. I mean, I really enjoyed doing that sort of live session thing. I think that was great fun. So I'll be doing lots more of those, because I think that's where my, it's like, if I do a solo album, it kind of goes like that. When David does his stuff by itself, it goes, cause he's a beautiful singer. I don't know if you've ever heard him sing. He's got a fabulous voice.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Brilliant. Mm-mm. Really, he's a great singer and a really good guitarist as well. So I think for him to express himself would probably be sort of more guitar based and maybe even singing. I mean, can't speak for him. He might say bagpipes and brass band, but probably not. But for me, it would tend to be with an orchestra probably, and probably slightly more classical. But I love bands like Sigur Rós and that kind of sound as well. Then I think it's that I'm trying to sort of find my own way in what those guys would call post-rock, but I'm sort of trying to avoid the genre of post-classical because it doesn't really mean anything, but I think that's probably where I would naturally find myself.
Mm. Thanks.
You also use some electronic music, right? I mean, you kind of have a nice mix of classical and electronic.
Well, that's it. It really is. Once you sort of allow yourself to say that anything's possible, and if it's expressive, then let's use it. It's a glorious time to be making music right now. It's a really, really interesting time to be doing it because you have got all these great, you know, the whole Icelandic movement. One of my best friends, Matt Robertson, is Björk's MD, or has been her musical director for the last tour. Whenever he's back home, we kind of go to the pub and sit and talk about it. And I go, she's got these crazy instruments that are made of 15 top high things that do all this. And so there's some wonderful, wonderfully interesting music being made.
Can I jump in and ask you again? It's because you're a music composer, you're a music editor, and you've done a lot of things related to that. And I was if you think about this year, for example, do you have any like soundtrack or any favorite thing you heard this year that really, you know, struck you as something really good in terms of movie or TV or something you really like in terms of music? Yeah,
I'm really, really lucky in that because I'm a member of BAFTA, they send us out screening DVDs of everything that's up so that we can vote for them. So unfortunately, they usually come out about November when we were quite busy, but I saved them all up me and my girlfriend sat here and tried to watch our way through pretty much everything that was in contention. But I have to say, my favourite film and score of the year was Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Oh,
it's not really a stealth boast because I did do an arrangement for it at the start of the film when they're in the cafe and there's a little crazy German or Hungarian band playing an Elgar tune in the style of 70s prog rock. That was me. That was my work. the score, Alberto Iglesias' score, is amazing. It's proper music. It's beautifully, beautifully done. It felt both fresh and of the time for me. I thought it was sophisticated music that worked really incredibly well. So I thought that was a fabulous, fabulous film and a great score. And pretty much anything that Alexandre Desplat does. He's an artist. He's a fabulous composer, incredibly hardworking, talented, and I sort of thank him in a way personally for spearheading in a way really that Dario Marinelli did before him, the sort of European movement in Hollywood, which I think is fabulous these days because it's sort of opened the door back up to really wonderful artistic music, being popular and used in films. So hurrah for Alexandre.
Wow. Yes. All right. So everyone obviously loves the Sherlock soundtrack. It's amazing, beautiful. Everyone just keeps talking about it all the time, constantly on Tumblr, Twitter, everything. So thank you so much. Thank you for being exceptionally talented. And we look really forward to series 3 and what other, you know, good musical treats you're going to give to us. So thank you so much.
It's an absolute pleasure, and I genuinely encourage anybody who's had the misfortune to sit through my ramblings this evening to come and join in on Twitter and Facebook, and because there'll be lots of things to share this year, more sessions, more stuff, and then you know hopefully with season 3 it'll be great to kind of you know to share some of the process maybe when we're recording for Sherlock for the next season if we're doing it.
So brilliant.
Yes. Come and say hi.
Babe.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yay. Well, Bray, it's lovely, really lovely to meet everybody, both here and out in the wider world. So, congrats and keep in touch. Hopefully I'll speak to you all again soon.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Yes. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Thank you. Bye-bye.
I actually have to agree with Michael and David fighting over the two favorite tracks because they're both my favorite tracks. So it's Blood on the Pavement and Sherlock. Yeah. Because it's kind of, they're both really string heavy and kind of, they're just awesome. They just do things. They're just really emotional. I like them.
It's like he was saying, it's big, hard-hitting movie music. It's not TV music anymore.
And I should go like one by one, like what our favorite ones are. And then just, we'll just start chatting from that, so you know. Turk, did you have like a favorite piece of the soundtrack, or like a favorite section, or note?
Oh, for once I don't have a favorite. I've got a favorite everything, but I really didn't have a favorite. I just, for me I studied music for such a long time, and it's just, for me it's when the music doesn't stand out, and oh, what's the music doing, that it's best, because obviously whatever it was so good, that I didn't stop to go, oh, the music. I was just so in it, and the music was helping so much with that. So I'm just going to say all of it, really, is my favourite. Mm.
Did you prefer season 1 or season 2?
Again, I have pretty much the same answer as I did to the first one.
Fair enough.
Doing it wrong or something, but...
I think that's doing it right. I mean, if the soundtrack, for me, it's kind of the same. Sometimes the soundtrack is just too prominent, like it was in Warhorse, and it was just too much. But if you don't notice it, because it just adds, or it just, like, it's part of what is happening.
I was going to say, it feels like it's part of the actual scene, like, because I can't imagine some of those scenes without the music. Like, it's sort of integrated, and because they have the emotional arcs, and it really just plays, like, what the actors are acting out, or, like, what the story is progressing.
Yeah, that just fits really well.
Yeah. Amy, what are your favorites?
There's been a lot of love for season 2, so I'm going to give some love for season 1 and just say music for me with TV shows is a lot of making them individual and making them stand out as much as anything like a set or an actor or anything. And I just remember hearing the music just over the title screen and having that moment where it kind of clicked in, even on the first episode where I went, oh my word, I really, really like this. And so I think, you know, just hearing that first piece, like, the first time, it was such an amazing experience for me that, I mean, obviously, I agree with everybody that season 2, you know, is a bit more nuanced in terms of what they were able to do with particular scenes and characters, but I think season 1 did such a great job of setting the tone of being something unique and something different that I have to say just that first time of hearing that, like, big, big, you know, music behind the title and going, this is Sherlock, this is what it's going to be.
I love the opening. It's my ringtone. I love it.
My alarm tone. I get woken up by it every morning.
Aw, that's lovely. Ready to
Mine's
go.
Still staying alive. It's my alarm tone, and I have to set about 4 alarms to wake up gradually, and I could honestly think I could kill on... If you played Staying Alive to me while tired, now I could probably be trained to kill on the sound of it.
Going off of the season one thing, obviously that's what started the whole, like, cry for a soundtrack, because everyone loved the music so much from series one. And I don't know if there's a certain track in particular, other than, like, the opening credits or, like, their respective themes that really stands out to me, but on the whole, it was just phenomenal.
Yeah, that's true. It just stays with you for a long time. And it's just immediately connected, too. So it's, you know, if you see images or if you see stills, you also hear the music, kind of. Or if you hear the music, you know what's happening in the action.
You were saying you didn't know which one was your favorite because you were sort of playing the Michael Price and David Arnold game.
Yeah. Well, because I really like Sherlock. That was just the one track that just, I don't know, that just did things to me.
It's beautiful.
I don't know. It just got me really emotional. But Blood on the Pavement is just so beautiful. Because it is so much, I don't know, there's just so many different themes in there. It's just really beautiful, sad piece of music, which kind of sums up everything that happened, like the entire action that happened. Because Sherlock is a really loud and very round kind of piece of music, whereas Blood on the Pavement is kind of summing up everything that happened in the episode and just kind of bringing it back to what's actually happening. So I don't know, I can't really decide, actually.
Is it Blood on the Pavement or One More Miracle that has sort of Sherlock's theme and John's theme mixing together?
That's one of my personal favorites. That's called Witch Bottle. That's from the end of series. That's from the end of Pink.
Okay, because I thought there's a part in Reichenbach that they did that as well. Maybe a bit more subtly, but I like when they mix the two together. Because it shows, like, a partnership and a friendship and all that kind of wibbly-wobbly stuff.
Yeah, we had a fan named Valerie Schreiner who actually had brought that up. It wasn't a question I was able to ask Michael when he was on, but she was commenting on how neat it is when their themes become intertwined and they're like a foundation, and you see them both together and they work so well together.
They do go well together, probably because, you know, the simplistic, I feel like Sherlock's theme is a lot more intense, and then of course John's is just 4 notes.
Yeah.
It's very emotive in those 4 notes.
Yeah, but it's basically the minor key version of Sherlock's theme.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, this is why they work so well together.
Yeah, well, there you go. The more you know. Imagine a rainbow.
I achieved that.
It's an awesome soundtrack because I would never be able to hear that soundtrack and not think of Sherlock the show. I have some soundtracks that I just think are pretty music, but I don't associate them as strongly. I think these are so wedded to the action on screen that I would never be able to listen to them without having sort of the emotional reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't really listen to the Series 2 soundtrack at all, pretty much. unless I'm somewhere where I have some quiet time on my own, like especially the whole of the Reichenbach Falls and some of the bits of Belgravia, it's just like, yeah, I kind of need a moment here now.
Yeah.
Very, very evocative.
So what are your favorites, Artie, that I guess you can listen to?
As I was saying, my favorite for the series one soundtrack is Witch Bottle from the end of Pink, because I can so clearly remember watching that for the first time and going, oh my god, the editing of what is happening on screen, the visuals and the cabbies talking, and then John's and Sherlock's theme kind of mixing in each other, and oh, it just all comes together. I just watching that on the screen happening, and I can remember my jaw dropping and just going, oh my god, this is actually pretty fucking amazing.
And
that's why Witch Bottle gets me every time. And for a series 2, full of great music, and it's very big and cinematic and awesome. But I think in terms of sounds and music, Baskerville is probably the episode that I find most interesting. And the track that I like most from the Baskerville soundtrack is Double Room, because it's so quirky and it's very different to the sounds that we hear in when Sherlock and John are in London.
Yeah, Baskerville in general, just it sounds so much different from all the other episodes, and I think it probably is because they're outside of London.
Yeah, I mean, you get the general, you get the violins and with Sherlock's theme and all, but on the whole, it's just, when you really listen to the episode, there's a lot happening in the background that I wouldn't even call, like, music. It's just the sounds that are used to add the effect of the horror kind of aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And Double Room kind of sits there, and it's just so quirky, and it's kind of, it's like what's happening on screen, because what's happening on screen is really quirky. You have all these really remarkable characters, these incidental characters that are, you know, memorable nonetheless. And it's the kind of music that's noticeable because it's different. I like that.
I like all the electronica music in Baskerville as well. It makes me want to have a rave.
It kind of went well with the sort of lab feel of everything and the scientific feel, I think, to have the electronic music.
Yeah.
What do you think, Turk? Could you make up an interpretive dance to electronic music in Baskerville?
I can up an interpretive dance to When the Microwave Beeps when it finishes. I think I could definitely do it to that. No, don't tempt me. I will.
Jen is working, but she says her favorite tracks are Numbers from Series 1 and Irene's theme from Series 2, which is quite beautiful, the one that Sherlock composes.
The one where I always have to close my eyes so I don't see her.
Well, Jeremy Brett couldn't play the violin either, so, you know.
The violin's notoriously difficult to play.
None of the actors who play horns usually can play it.
I'm trying to think of what my favorites are. I like the Witch Bottle one that Artie likes a lot. And then, yeah, Blood on the Paper's just really good. Sherlock, God, I like them all. I also like One More Miracle because I'm a masochist.
And oh, that's a good one.
It is. It's so sad, but then how it blends into, like, the theme again. And it's like, no. Da, 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 da,
da. I always find that that's, like, the little ray of hope at the end there.
Yeah.
That's kind of what makes it bearable to listen to. As opposed to Blood on the Pavement, for example.
It was perfect, because I think, because, like, after you saw, like, the coat collar, and then that music starts, so then you get the swell, like, oh my god, yes! It's like we were talking about before, like, it's all interconnected, and it's, you can't have one without the other, and it has this whole big emotive splurge that just makes you feel things that you shouldn't feel for a television show, but you do.
Well, and how much do I love that we're not having pop music montages that we're going to watch in 5 years and go, oh yeah, that was that song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
it's not being dated in the same way. Have you guys heard, somebody, their username is BattleAngel25, had asked if they actually wanted me to ask Michael, but if we had heard the 8-bit music by K Clavier, I guess, that's the, like, Nintendo Sherlock theme.
It's amazing. Oh. I tweeted David Arnold it. And Michael Price on the BSB Twitter account, and David Arnold had retweeted it. So I think he gave sort of like his consent.
Oh, yeah. That's good. I think it's hilarious.
It's great. I love all the 8-bit themes that people make. But yeah, the Sherlock one is really great. It has like this really like pixelated Sherlock. Like, it looks like he's dancing or something. I'm not quite sure. But yes, the 8-bit theme is amazing. I'm pretty sure it's on our Tumblr.
Somebody named Stay Laurelis said, I love the parallel structuring of the opening titles and Sherlock's theme, but a friend and I noticed that Sherlock's theme ends in a major chord in the, what they call, synth-tastic pilot episode, and a minor chord in the actual series, and they were going to ask him about the differences in the music, which he actually discussed, obviously, but I do think that kind of shows one of the major differences. Obviously, the pilot, unaired pilot, was a lot more, like, major chordy, and they let it be a lot more sort of ambiguous and minor, I think, in the aired episode. Maybe you guys have thoughts on that. I think it reflects a difference in, like, the tone and the mood of how the episodes ended up being cut. I've watched the pilot enough to make a good comment on that, but
I've only seen the pilot once. I giggled through most of it.
I just couldn't manage more than like one good watching for information's sake.
It's adorable. It's adorable. It's so good. It's adorable.
I've seen it so many times.
Really? See, I just love studying Pink so much that I don't, cause watching, it's weird cause like watching the pilot, I feel like it's like a fan fiction of it, even though it came first.
That's so true.
I don't know, I just see it as two totally different entities somehow.
They're quite different. Yeah, so I do like, I enjoy how it, they have the ending scene in the flat. I think that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
If I could have the ideal restaurant scene, though, it would be a mashup of the Pink one and the unaired pilot one.
The Pink one is
the
so
unaired pilot. It was just,
the pilot one's so awkward. So it's great.
Oh my god.
I'm not asking you out.
And the scene on the roof.
Oh god, that's
awesome. Oh, I should probably mention, since this will be coming out right after the news, Series 3 filming early 2013.
Yeah.
So the world can't end. I think that's as early as it could conceivably actually be, considering how busy everyone is.
Right.
Yeah.
Which means it's another 18 months.
At least.
Yeah. Oh well. We did it. Did it once. We'll do it again. We're well trained.
And at least we know that there's more coming. Just imagine the poor Victorians.
I know. In comparison, we have it easy.
Exactly. Exactly.
And we know that about 6 months before they start shooting, Moffat and Gators will post things on Twitter and just tease us all relentlessly all over again, and we're all gonna eat it up all over again because we're suckers.
Yep. So Moffat did say that Moriarty isn't likely to come back, considering he shot his brains out.
Yeah.
In theory, air quotes, italics, underlined, whatever.
Oh, we're not having undead Moriarty? I was so hoping.
Oh, I don't like zombies. I'm really scared of zombies.
No zombie Moriarty.
Yeah, but zombie Moriarty could, like, change your perception of zombies forever.
Or just make me terrified of Andrew and Moriarty and just everything, like, waking up.
Staying alive will have a whole new meaning. Yeah, so I'm hoping Charles Augustus Milverton makes it in series 3.
Me too.
Yeah.
Want Milvy.
I'm kind of hoping for that, especially because Moffat has said he'd like to tackle some different villains because he thinks there are some awesome villains in the Sherlock Holmes stories. I would love Moran, but it may not happen.
Well, he better be in it. He's my favorite in the whole thing.
Well, we've got to have the empty house, which will probably be, you know, the empty flat.
Yeah.
Moran has to be in it. It has to. He's the whole... Like...
But then he won't be any of my top choices, and I'll still be like, oh, but he was there, but he wasn't... He wasn't one of my favorites. Oh, no. A team of Moran. That's what they are. They're actually... Moran's actually the name of a team of snipers.
Oh, that'd be cool.
That could be a possibility.
I like it.
Moffat and Gatiss, take note.
Yes, but we only want a team of snipers if they're Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and Zubin Varla, thank you. So we can have an Irish one and a Middle Eastern one. That's a good combination.
That would be very modern.
That's what you gotta do.
When's the CBS thing going to... Do we actually have a date for that?
Well, no, I don't think they finished the script.
But it'll be up for season 3, right?
Well, it depends if it gets greenlit. Because they can make a pilot, and then it depends if it gets enough reviews, ratings... of an audience, and then if it's greenlit, then they'll commission it for how many episodes or whatever. But of course, America has no issue canceling things after, like, you know, like one or two episodes.
That's true. It's such good shows. But if it's bad, it's probably going to get like 10 seasons.
Who knows? I think it probably will be greenlit because there's been so much talk about it, and they're doing
it. That's what I was going to say. Publicity.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all publicity at the moment, so I do think it will be greenlit. How long it will last will obviously depend on the strength of it. So
I just really hope that it's going to be really, really cool.
Yeah, it's like you can't pass judgment. And like a lot of people have been asking us questions, and it's like we're not saying anything because we can't. It's, you know, I'll be the first to admit that I thought a modern Sherlock Holmes was stupid, and here I am now.
From a personal point of view and from what I've seen, like, there's someone on Tumblr who's read the script.
Oh, seriously?
Oh, I saw that. Someone said that.
I'm just so curious.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Sherlock Gnomes is coming out.
I can't wait for that!
Oh my god!
I love Gnomey and Juliet. I loved it. All the Shakespeare references. I was just sitting there and rubbing my hands in glee. And if they do that, like, with canon, oh, it's gonna be epic.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?